Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
You know, as much as it can feel so overwhelming, the extent to which technology is sort of eating the world right now, it's also important to remember that there are many different mechanisms by which we can change what sorts of control and power technology and technology companies have. And it's worth finding those, particularly at the local level, at the city level, which is where a lot of this is happening, but also is a place where it's much easier to get engaged and where policy can come up and act in a much more quick manner.
Smart cities have captured the imagination of urban dwellers, of city council members, mayors, governors, all kinds of policymakers. But what are the advantages and disadvantages of smart technologies and smart cities in particular? And how can we begin to think about the possible impacts of smart technology on the very people who live in urban environments? Today on New Books in Technology, we have Ben Green, the author of the new book, The Smart Enough City, Putting Technology in Its Place to Reclaim Our Urban Future. Welcome back to New Books in Technology. I am your host, Jasmine McNeely.
One of the first things we always like to do on New Books in Technology is learn about the author. So tell us about yourself. Who is Ben Green?
Yeah, so I am a PhD candidate in applied math at Harvard, and I've always been interested in both technology and particular computer science and data science, but also in cities and city government and urban planning, and have sort of throughout my undergraduate and graduate years really been focused on how new technology and how data science can be applied to city governments, and did a lot of that work in the city of Boston and working with other cities. And from there, increasingly began to see that many of the issues about how to use technology well and the social impact of technology in cities were not just about the technology itself, but were about questions of governance and politics and the social context around the technology. And so that's been really the focus of my work and the focus of my book, thinking about how do we understand the role and impacts of technology from a broad perspective that looks at many different factors and fully understands what's going on, as opposed to just thinking about these issues solely as technology problems. And so that's really what drives me in my work.
So hold up. You said you were a math PhD.
Yeah.
So many people would think, okay, what the heck does math have to do with all the things that you're just talking about?
Yeah, that's a great question. So increasingly, city governments are looking to data, big data, and algorithms. So different types of mathematical formulas to try to find patterns within data and to make sense and to make predictions about, based on historical data, to find patterns within data, to understand what's going on within the city. And that's a major trend within city governments over the last 10 years in particular, although it's certainly been going on for much longer than that. So that was really my entry point into these questions, was as someone with a math and computer science background, trying to help city governments make sense of all of that data and to take advantage of statistical inferences to make sense of data.
Mm-hmm. So the book is The Smart Enough City. What, first of all, what is a smart anything?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's sort of, I like that to start with that actually, that it's not just about this idea of the smart city, but this idea of the smart anything. And, you know, I think we're all pretty familiar with the idea of a smartphone, but there's also, you know, there's the smart home, the smart toaster, the smart toothbrush, all of these different sort of implements or places where the word smart is being adopted. And really what I take it to mean is just the adoption of some form of digital technology, whether that's internet connectivity, data collection, connection to an app on your smartphone, something like that. So it's sort of this broad term, often a bit of a buzzword, if not always a bit of a buzzword, that says you're taking something that has traditionally been sort of an analog, non-digital item and incorporating some form of digital technology into that item and how its function works.
Mm-hmm. Now, this brings me to the second part of your title, which is putting mm-hmm. technology in its place to reclaim our urban future. What is the place of technology with respect to urbanism?
Mm-hmm. So that's really the ultimate question that I think we are, as a society and as cities, are facing today. It's really trying to think about what is the role of technology. And what I've been seeing and what I really target in the book is this idea, this sort of over-heightened role for technology, this pedestal that technology has been put on, such that it is seen as the ideal type of solution to every problem, as superior to other forms of knowledge, other forms of policymaking, as a way to address urban challenges. And there are, you know, I see many dangers with that, which we can get into, but that is sort of the goal. The core goal of the book is to recenter the relationship between how we think about cities and innovation and progress with respect to technology, and moving away from a lens where we think of technology as always the ideal approach for working within cities, towards one where we understand both the potential but also the limits and dangers of new technology in these contexts.
So one of the phrases that you use related to what you were just talking about is the tech goggles, as a form of tech solutionism that you really get into. Where do we see tech goggles currently when we think about smart cities and smart city governance?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so just the broad framing of tech goggles that I talk about throughout the book is, right, this idea of how does the world look like, what does the world look like through the lens of technology, through perhaps the way that an engineer would see the world. And it's sort of, right, very similar to techno-solutionism, and other people have certainly come up with similar ideas and similar phrases. And but it's really this sense of, you know, what does the world look like when you're coming at it from the perspective of everything is a technology problem and I can solve every problem with technology. So there are a lot of different domains where that comes to play. There are certainly, but I think this general idea in the smart city that we need to build, you know, different companies talk about building cities from the internet up, or building digital connectivity at the core of the city. And this idea that is, if you have digital technology and in the backbone of the city, that will then be the ideal thriving city. and this is everywhere from public safety to civic engagement to transportation, where I'll maybe focus on transportation briefly, this idea that, well, if we were just able to have the, you know, new self-driving cars and new connections between all of the infrastructure on our streets and those self-driving cars, we can optimize traffic and suddenly we'll have these utopian cities where congestion is eliminated. And this So it's this approach of taking what is this complex urban problem, in this case of mobility, one that has not just many different dimensions in terms of the mobility challenges, but also it touches on issues of urban planning and sustainability and equity and education and all of these other aspects, and turning it into a technical optimization problem.
Mm-hmm. So is there a disconnect between technologists and what technologists think we should be doing to have a better city or better urban environment, and also politicians, and then also actual city residents and what city residents think they need and believe would be the best way to solve many of the longstanding urban problems?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are a handful of different disconnects. I think definitely one of them is the perspective of the technologists, who tend not to have a deep understanding of the broader social context of these problems or the broader policy and political landscape of what actually would make sense as a solution. And I remember when I was working in Boston City Hall as a data scientist, sometimes talking to my colleagues in the computer science department at Harvard, and they would be talking about their great ideas for what types of technology would be really helpful for the police department or the transportation department. And, you know, I felt like, well, these are solutions that sound really great when you're talking in the abstract, but actually would not work for, don't actually solve the particular problems that these departments are facing, and would not actually fit into the types of policy solutions that are feasible within those contexts. So there's definitely a disconnect between technologists and the sort of city urban realities. In many cases, the politicians are split. In some cases, politicians and other urban leaders certainly do understand that urban context, but in other cases, certainly, especially the politicians, do adopt the sort of techno-utopian language as a way of, you know, in many ways, branding the city as one that's progressive and forward-thinking. A lot of cities have smart city initiatives and will talk a great deal about their smart city programs as a way of branding the city as one that's working into the 21st century, trying to attract jobs and all of that. So there is a little bit of the broader political landscape here that does tend to take these technological solutions as ideal and as valuable. And I think one of the things that I want to help shift is to turn that conversation, not just among the technologists, but also among city leaders who begin to see more of the dangers of this technology and more of the really just the complexities of the technology, that it's not something that necessarily means your city is going to improve. And then the last disconnect, I think in many ways the strongest disconnect, is between the politicians and the technologists on the one hand, and then the general public on the other, who very often don't end up seeing the benefits of this technology and aren't always clamoring for this type of technology. And we definitely, I saw this disconnect really firsthand when I was working for the city of Boston. We were trying to help implement a new website and program for open data, for data sets that the city had collected that we were going to release publicly for anyone to use. And there was this idea that doing so would improve civic engagement, improve transparency, and all of that by enabling anyone in the city of Boston to use much of the city's data. And we went out to public libraries across the city and started trying to talk to people. We set up booths in different libraries. And whenever we would ask people about the data, we would ask them, you know, what sorts of data sets are you interested in? What would you like to see? What data questions do you have? They totally did not care. They had very little interest in having that type of conversation. And they ultimately did not view their problems in terms of technology problems. When we talked to them in more general terms, we asked them, how long have you lived in this neighborhood? How do you like the schools? How do you like the parks? What sorts of things are you concerned about? We had very long conversations, but they were not conversations that hinged on technology or problems that ultimately technology could solve. And so there was this very strong disconnect. And then one line that someone said to me still sticks with me, where an older resident who'd lived in Boston for years said, you know, information is perfectly fine, but I want a way to influence what's happening. And I think that that's really important to remember, that the technology is not necessarily inherently empowering to the public or actually addressing the types of day-to-day or even long-term sustained systemic problems that people in the public are actually facing.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So as a just like a foundational questions, haven't cities always used technology, or aren't cities always haven't they always been a place where technology is and technology is used for some kind of benefit to the populace?
Mm-hmm.
What makes smart cities different?
I think there are many ways in which the smart city is a continuation of other urban trends. Cities definitely have always been places where different technologies have sort of come in and change the landscape. You know, I think the car being, you know, sort of the most obvious parallel here, where that was a new technology that came in and completely reshaped cities. And while in many senses the car did improve people's ability to get around and other things like that, we also saw the dangers of building cities from the perspective of that was overly centered on how do we focus on this new technology of cars and how do we really emphasize automobile travel as the thing we want to sort of optimize for or value in this city. So I think that there are definitely other technologies and other ways of historical examples of thinking about cities through the lens of technology. And there's always been this sort of utopian strain of thinking about the future of cities from that perspective. And I think that that's really useful, both because we can look to some of these historical parallels and see how, even though there were opportunities, focusing too heavily on the technologies without thinking about the risks and the complexities actually led to a great deal of harm in many cases, thinking about the mid to late 20th century push towards highways through downtowns and how that decimated many communities. And also, I think, can point to the ways in which the smart city is in many ways sort of this branding strategy, that what seems to be this new generation of urban possibility is something that has emerged from a great deal of marketing and lobbying from technology companies that are trying to find new spaces where they can sell technology and are sort of creating a marketplace almost out of thin air by convincing cities and city leaders and others that this is sort of the vision that they should be having for themselves.
Now, you've used this word more than once in our conversation so far, and that is utopianism. So both just regular utopianism, but then techno-utopianism. What is utopianism and how is it kind of shaped how people view governance, but also urbanism and now technology with respect to urban spaces?
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think of the of utopianism as, I guess, you know, having a vision of what a perfect or ideal society could be, and or at least one that is, you know, very substantially improved and where many of the problems that we currently face today are gone. And on the one hand, utopianism is valuable, right? To achieve any sort of social change requires having a vision of what you're actually trying to work towards. I'm not someone who says, you know, all we can do is make small tweaks around where we are today, and that's all we should think about. But I think that, you know, the danger of utopianism is that it ultimately involves a great deal of abstraction and a great deal of sort of removing the realities of what we are, where we are today. And in that sense, the choices about what to hold and what to get rid of are incredibly consequential. And utopian visions can always sort of, they do shape the direction of where we're headed in the future and where we get to, where we're moving. And so in that sense, you know, I think that this raises, going back to that last question of the sort of corporate element of all of this, is this question of who gets to shape these narratives, who has the power to create utopian narratives that then are adopted by city governments and are adopted by foundations and the press as the sort of unifying narrative of where, what trends are happening and where we are going and where we should be going. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, you know, maybe the danger of this type of utopianism is that when we are existing in this environment where these, you know, multinational, multi-billion dollar tech companies are able to put forward these types of visions and that shapes where this is going, that constituency suddenly has an incredible amount of influence over the broader conversation. And the other piece of this being that when we focus too much on the utopian visions, and so, or maybe a different way of saying it is that the utopian visions can be incredibly powerful ways of organizing and thinking about a conversation or where we should go. And the danger becomes when we start implementing solutions that are grounded within that utopian vision into the real world that we have today. And sort of this gap between what makes sense in perhaps some utopian ideal world and what actually will happen when we implement that type of solution in the very non-ideal world that we have today. Mm-hmm. And there are historical examples of how when you sort of try to implement that type of solution into the real world, all of the things that you've erased suddenly come to the fore because those are still there. And that can lead what seems like a utopian solution, whether it's digital technology or different forms of urban planning, to actually be quite dystopian in practice.
Hmm. So you mentioned dystopia. Mm-hmm. There's been quite a lot of controversy surrounding smart cities, whether it's in Toronto with the Quayside, but also, mm-hmm. and to a lesser extent, Hudson Yards in New York. In fact, CityLab named 2018, so last year, the year of the smart city skeptic. So what do you think people are waking up to with regard to the drawbacks of a smart city and the public-private partnerships that are happening in these smart zones?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm glad that second part to me is absolutely key, which is the public-private partnerships. And I actually think there's been a trend, and certainly there have been smart city skeptics pretty much for as long as there have been smart cities. Mm-hmm. You know, I there's a great book by Adam Greenfield, Against the Smart City, that I think was published in 2013. And that was, you know, very influential to me and others who have worked in this space. So certainly there's been that strain of thought. I think that really the initial organizing around critiques of smart cities starting several years ago was largely about questions of privacy, about the sense of, you know, putting sensors or cameras across the city, whether that's on streetlights or trash cans or any other type of infrastructure, creates an incredible surveillance network throughout the city for both the government and in particular law enforcement, and also for private companies. And so there have been huge amounts of concern and pushback about that. And then I would say that starting around 2018 and really picking up in 2019, the additional concern along with privacy was this question of privatization and people realizing the extent to which these smart city projects were happening through public-private partnerships where city governments were handing over not just data collection capabilities, but also control of assets and incredible amounts of decision-making power over to private companies. And I think that's sort of what connects this question of Toronto, where Sidewalk Labs, which is an Alphabet or Google company, is building out a new neighborhood, or at least trying to build out a new neighborhood, very much focused on technology, to Hudson Yards, which would not be, you know, I wouldn't sort of think of Hudson, something like Hudson Yards. You could think about Amazon HQ2, also in New York. I wouldn't think of those as being under sort of the standard smart city umbrella. But they absolutely are connected to these other smart city projects from the perspective of large public-private partnerships where investors and companies get to develop neighborhoods or be in control of huge swaths of land and really build those out in a particular way. And I think that that is, in many cases, almost more than the data, or as much as the data collection, is the story of smart cities and is the battle, I think, that currently is ongoing to figure out to what extent, whether it's a technology company that wants to build technology like Google, or a technology company that wants to build a campus like Amazon, or investors that want to build sort of a fancy, whatever we want to call Hudson Yards, sort of shopping business center, whether or not that's going to be allowed for them to have that type of control and get those massive public benefits and things like that. So in many ways, that's also a huge unifying thread here that isn't about the technology itself.
So do we need smart cities?
Definitely not. So I think that, you know, as I've described, there are many harms to the smart city and to the idea, again, sort of to that, to the utopian unifying idea of the smart city as a place, that there's, you know, if we were to just have more digital technology and more advanced and use it more and use it better, that we would have better cities. And I think that's just fundamentally a misguided approach to think about what urbanism is and what urban challenges are and what would improve cities. But that doesn't mean we have to throw out technology entirely. The sort of the shift that I try to focus on is from the smart city, one where, you know, doing better, being smarter means having more technology, to the smart enough city, mm-hmm. where we haven't erased the idea of technology, but suddenly we're thinking about it not as an end in itself, but as a means towards other outcomes and other solutions. I sort of think of when it's framed as the smart enough city, suddenly if the goal is to be smart enough, you have to think about, okay, smart enough for what? What are we actually trying to accomplish here? And the different case studies I talk about throughout the book are organized around different sort of actual aspirations and values that we should have for cities, you know, an inclusive city, a livable city, a just city, a democratic city. And then the question becomes, to what extent can technology be a useful tool in achieving certain elements of those values and of those broader goals? Mm-hmm. And in the different cities that I look at in practice, all of the, I would say, best outcomes are the ones where cities had, they already had a long-term planning vision. They had a holistic approach that in many cases that wasn't just focused on technology. It was, you know, they were changing practices. They were hiring new types of people. They were creating new policies and new partnerships. And then the technology provides particular opportunities to enhance some of those programs, to provide better information, or to make certain aspects of those programs more efficient. But the sort of core of the innovation and the change there is from cities that are approaching from a long-term perspective, aren't just chasing the latest fads of technology, and have been doing long-term deep thinking about where do we want to be in 5, 10, 50 years, and how do we get there? And then only at that point does the question of how can technology help come in, as opposed to starting from we need technology, how can we throw technology at more problems?
Mm-hmm. What's next for you?
Mm-hmm. So I think that the you know, within this context of smart cities, one of the biggest areas is, you know, actually now not just shifting the conversation, but trying to get some policy changes and get cities thinking differently about this. So one of the things that I've been pretty involved in throughout since the publication of the book earlier this year has been working with different cities to implement new types of laws and policies, in particular to prevent surveillance. So actually just later this week, there will be a hearing at New York City Council about an act that would require require transparency about any surveillance technology that the New York Police Department is either acquiring or using. And that's sort of part of a broader trend of cities that have been pushing forward some of those ordinances. And I'm working on a testimony for that. So building out these types of laws that actually provide some form of transparency and ultimately democratic control over technology is one place where I've been really passionate about. And then I've also been somewhat involved in the various battles going on in Toronto. Among other things, there is a ongoing lawsuit that I have been a sort of expert witness for that. Have a brief that's, you know, now up online. So that's another place we're really trying to push back on some of these public-private partnerships and the broad surveillance capabilities that they are creating and trying to help shift this conversation. And I see Toronto as sort of ground zero for a lot of this sort of this where this battle is playing out, and will really shape what types of technologies and what types of public-private partnerships and management structures are ultimately going to be seen as feasible within within cities. And so that project is very much up in the air. It's not entirely clear where it's going to go. And there are a lot of great organizers on the ground in Toronto who are doing work also to point out the limits of what this program is providing, and in particular, the ways that Sidewalk Labs has sort of eschewed any sort of real, genuine democratic process for what this city is going to look like. And I think that that's, you know, sort of setting will ultimately set some of the boundaries of what smart the next, you know, 5 years of smart city projects actually looks like.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Ben. Thanks for coming on the show. And
yeah, thank you so much.
This has been New Books in Technology. Have a great week. We'll be right back.